Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black. And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes, we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rhett Bray.
We'll talk about wellness, is how we can start to communicate the importance of the wellness, and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting, we take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the light, the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address, either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership. I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers. They make things happen. And sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get into that leadership position so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of LA doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of LA where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money. They're looking to invest in income property. I would say good strategy might be to join up with others who are doing the same. There are some crowdfunding sites that offer some opportunities to do that, but I would be careful just jumping in and talk to an expert in the multifamily business. I think over time it will prove to be lucrative.
Protecting your assets is important, but when you do it is even more important. Here's attorney Harry Barth.
A very important component to understand is that, as with all business deals, asset protection being just one of them, is to be able to settle a proposed claim within reasonable limits. It's very, very difficult to do that if you're in jeopardy of losing your home, losing your business, and losing your life savings. So I think that it's important that asset protection is granular. We look at the various components, we take into consideration all of the goals and objectives of our particular clients, and there's not one size fits all. Every situation is different, every background is different, every family makeup is different, every business transaction is different.
What's the best way to use Twitter and other social media? We asked expert Tim Templeton.
I just had a friend ask me today, I don't really get Twitter. What is the value? And I said, you know, it's two things. It's self-promotion, or business promotion in this case, and it's research. So if you want people to know who you are and what you're doing, and you create content, you create blog content, you want people to see it, one of the best ways to get it out in front of people is to send out an announcement using Twitter. Likewise, if you're trying to find people in your ecosystem, your business, the analysts, the resellers, the potential partners, you can find them by their activity on Twitter. You can interact with them. You can follow them. You can retweet things that they're sending. And you can create a relationship that way, which is a lot easier than it used to be.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
What are some of the factors that go into evaluating a business at any given time? We asked valuation expert Christopher Mercer.
It's one thing to say that your value is worth what a willing buyer and a willing seller will pay, but that same willing buyer and same willing seller won't pay the same thing in 2008 as they will in 2014, because in 2008 the world was full of uncertainty that caused financing to dry up, and it was enormously difficult to sell. Some of your listeners that are listening to this need to think about the fact that they need to be thinking of an orderly transition of management and ownership, because when bad things happen to your company, you lose all flexibility in terms of ownership and management transition. So take care of those things now while you can.
Being in business is inherently risky. We all know that. But what are some of the most common mistakes that business owners make and their potential solutions? We asked for comments from attorney Mayar Ghassemian.
One of the important mistakes is not having a corporation or LLC or another form of entity that would limit their liability in case they get sued. I have seen a lot of companies that do this, and it's very prevalent in the construction industry. If they are around for a while and they don't have an entity, they are going to be sued sometimes, especially in construction. And what happens is, and they put their own personal properties in danger because they don't have an entity that would protect them.
What are some of the important factors that go into a professional business valuation? We asked expert Roger Winsby.
Valuation is really about a sense of future opportunities offset by the risks. And if you don't really think those through as it relates to each individual company, you won't really understand whether you might be above average on that multiple or below average, but it's going to be quite rare when you're right on the average or the median. So it's quite an issue that comes up in terms of understanding, you know, the business and being able to document your findings. Valuation is really about future, and as much as, you know, people want to say, well, you know, here are my retained earnings and here's what I've done, and that's, you know, very important context, but ultimately if someone wants to buy the business, they're buying the future opportunity and weighing that against the future risks.
You know, a lot of business owners I talk to have an image in their mind of how they're going to put up a for sale sign and sell their business quickly and easily, get a big check and invest it. Here's a message from someone who's done it, Veronica Saldivar.
A lot of folks just think, I'm going to sell for X amount of dollars. And, you know, especially here for us in California and other similar states, taxes are a huge, huge consideration. It takes a big bite at your bottom line. I think also one of the other things is to consult with a CPA on that tax liability. When I was negotiating the sale of my business and negotiating the purchase and sale agreement, I also met several times with a tax attorney as well. He helped me draft the documents to prepare to make sure that I was going to fall under cap gains tax treatment, which was huge.
When you're undertaking a big project like exit planning, it's important to know that your advisors are using a specific process. Here's Leo Klein.
Our approach is to say, well, let's have initially that conversation. Let's do some initial fact finding on everything that is in, you know, that it needs to be looked at to develop that strategy. And once we sort of have developed the strategy, what we do is present that strategy in sort of in a team meeting to all the other advisors, and if needed, we bring in some new advisors if there are certain gaps. Here's the strategy, here are the facts. Let's discuss this and provide your input and suggestions. Let's refine the strategy based on your expertise, and then let's finalize it and then implement it. And then from my perspective, best practice is that sort of you repeat this process once a year until you conduct your exit.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
If you're going to grow your business, you've got to grow your sales. Here's Brad Leggett.
One of the key things we work with is performance management. How do you set targets? How do you get a sales team to perform? Because in about roughly half the companies we go into, there aren't formal sales targets in place. And that can be very demotivational to a sales team because they don't know where they're expected to perform to. You often have a very frustrated CEO or head of sales that says, well, the team's not doing well, but they haven't articulated what that target is. And our approach is you work with the sales team to set targets. I mean, the first piece of advice I've got is get a sales target that's written down and put it in front of everybody. That's step one.
Okay.
At least have that. But it's much better to set targets with the sales team's involvement. So sit down, and you don't want to walk into this meeting with a salesperson without some idea of the sales target. You'll have an idea of where it should be. Let's talk about where we think we can get to this year and what our target is.
What are some of the key things that a buyer looks for when they're buying a business? We asked a gentleman who's bought a lot of businesses, Ace Chapman, for his ideas.
The two things that we focus on when either we buy a business outright or we go in and invest in a business is we want the operations really to kind of be everything to be there. What we add on top of that is two things. Most people have not spent a lot of time investing or building out their marketing funnel. And the second part of that is having almost like a franchise-like operations manual that allows the person to come in and feel really comfortable that you're going to be able to run the business and take over from where you are. You want to stand out and have those kind of extras that just make it an easy investment for the buyer.
Technology is here to stay, and having a technology plan is becoming very important. Here's expert Jim Blue.
And a lot of people have a business plan, but they don't have a technology plan. What type of equipment do I need? What type of services that I need? A large percentage of my time is helping people brush up on basic computer skills. I help them select the right equipment, programs, and services, really based on their individual needs. And anytime something new comes out, I'm getting phone calls and emails in terms of whether they should upgrade, whether they should get a new product. You know, the name of the game now is setting up a home office. Most people have some type of technology in their home. There's a big difference between using it for personal use and for using it for business use. And I have to really separate that based on how much time someone's going to be spending in their office and what they do for a living.
What are some of the trends because of the global economy? We asked international law expert Kenneth August.
You mentioned manufacturing. That's a perfect example of where the thinking today is very different from where it was even 5 years ago. And by that I mean traditionally a company might look at outsourcing their manufacturing, let's say to China as an example, in order to lower their cost of production.
Mm-hmm.
But really, with the consumer markets moving into those countries where they were outsourcing, it makes a lot more sense today to look not at a unilateral outsourcing manufacturing play, but how can you develop a revenue base and profitability in that local market? And maybe instead of doing all your outsourcing in China, you also have manufacturing in Eastern Europe or in Latin America, and they become concentric circles of new markets that you can sell your products and services into.
Most people think of planning for their death when they visit with an estate planning attorney, but here's another viewpoint from estate planning attorney Michael Wittick.
I tell people all the time, you know, you probably came to me to plan for your death when the baby boomer's biggest problem, I think, is disability. In fact, there are things worse than death, and some types of disability fall into that category. They've already done a study in 2014 and determined that in California, the average cost of long-term care is now $94,000. I would say in almost every case, I recommend that people go get a long-term care insurance consultation just so that they can find out, because that's one of the things that is rapidly changing right now to take care of this increased cost. They are repackaging it, and there are new companies in, and some older companies that used to offer it are now out of California. Things are changing in that field just like many others.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to have you with me. And, you know, I have such great guests. I'm very blessed in that regard. And I hope you enjoy today's interviews. My first guest is Amber Goff from Talent Fusion Point, where she is the founder and professional recruiter. And Amber is in the business of professional recruiting and talent acquisition consulting. And she's going to talk about the talent acquisition revolution and recruiting in today's candidate-driven job market. Amber, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So, Amber, before we get into this very interesting topic, very timely for what's going on in today's job market, tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you got started and how you came to start Talent Fusion Point.
Absolutely. I look forward to chatting with you and diving into talent acquisition. I myself hail from the great state of Utah, where I lived there most of my life, and I grew up in a rather dynamic blended family, and that created a lot of questions as a young lady. So when it came time for me to select a major in college, I decided to study family and human development with a family therapy emphasis. And it was an exciting topic for me, and I was a little burned out after I graduated, so I took some time off before entering right into my major, and actually served as a victims advocate for a couple of years. And so I always call myself a recovering social worker, because this is back in pager days. I wore a pager, the police would page me, I'd go out to some pretty heavy things. I would take people to the hospital. I would check them into shelters. It was a really tough topic for a young lady. So I was part of that statistic that I was told in college, that social workers burn out at about the 2 to 3 year mark. And truly, at the exact 2 year mark, I was packing up my Plymouth Sundance and moving, much to my small town mother's dismay, to Salt Lake City. Of course, the big scary city of Salt Lake, and wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I knew I wasn't going to be a victim's advocate anymore. It was very hard work for a young lady, and I admire people who can stay in that space for a long time. Long story short, I landed, fortunately, in recruiting. I was hired by a large publicly held recruiting firm, and I have been had the opportunity for the last 18 years to work in recruiting. I worked with a large company, a small boutique, and then about a little over 5 years ago, when I moved here to San Diego, I founded Talent Fusion Point, which is a purpose-driven recruiting and consulting firm. And I've loved serving the business owners here in San Diego and getting to know everyone here. I've really enjoyed it, and it's a great move. It's obviously sunnier and warmer here than it is in Utah right now.
Well, I'm sure the early talents that you developed in your early career have come in handy to help people as they're trying to figure out their direction, and you know, individuals are have more choices than ever these days. We have a full job market, but a lot of opportunities out there. So let me ask you a couple questions here. First of all, is what is a candidate-driven market, and what are the main challenges you see in recruiting in a candidate-driven market?
That's a great question. And when I think about candidate-driven market, there are a couple of ways to see it. First, kind of the more obvious, when you look at the economy, low unemployment rates, of course, the power is assumed to be in the candidate's hands for the most part. There's just fewer candidates out there looking. It's harder to find them because they're already employed. You can't just post what they call, like, affectionately post and pray that someone, the right candidate, will apply for the position. You actually have to be a little more active about it in terms of finding the right candidates. But it's even deeper than that. Today's business climate's really shifting, and I'm sure many of your listeners have heard things such as some of these catchphrases like business for good, social enterprise, higher purpose, mm-hmm. conscious capitalism. All of those things are very hot topics right now. And a matter of fact, in a recent study, Business Management, they found that 94% of millennials want to use their skills to benefit a cause. And so what I mean by that is that you can't just – it's the candidates are shopping. Millennials are shopping for jobs. They're not just going to apply and take a job just to have a job. They will turn down a job if they don't feel like it's in alignment with either their higher purpose or that they're not actually using their skills for a greater good and to impact the world in a positive way. So employers really have to be in touch with their higher purpose and know how to communicate that through employment branding, and they've got to know how to find the right candidates in order to really build their team.
It's interesting. I had heard, of course, that millennials are looking for purpose-driven types of firms, but I hadn't heard the statistics that are so high that so many of them, almost all of them, are looking for that. So you describe your organization as a purpose-driven recruiting firm. What does that mean, and how does that help your clients?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, I'm a recovering social worker. So recruiting's perfect for me. So I'll kind of double back, and then I'll answer your question. It's still serving at my higher purpose, which is connecting people and really making a difference in the lives of those I serve. So whether that be through, of course, my recruiting practice. So I'm very purpose-driven, which means that I serve as a true extension of my client's team. I really get in there. I know who they are. I understand what their culture is. And if we find individuals who are really in alignment with their higher purpose, they're going to perform better. That's just very simply put. They're going to perform better. They're going to be happier and stay longer. You have better retention. It really, truly affects the company. It's also known to increase innovation, and people are more creative when they are inspired by the work that they're doing. And so I really seek to discover what my client's purpose is and their higher kind of purpose and their why, and find people who are in alignment with it, and that becomes better retention and better productivity.
That all makes a lot of sense, especially in, again, the group that's looking for purpose in their employment. Do you consider that you are outside of the lines of typical recruiting by asking specific questions to understand that more? Does that make you is that your unique edge?
Yeah, I definitely believe so. Now, I'm certain that there are recruiters that are out there that are digging deep and understanding culture, and there's a part of that. But I do feel as though the recruiting industry is sometimes a little bit broken in the sense that they're not really serving as a true extension. They're acting more like vendors that are just throwing resumes to the wall and hoping they're going to stick and that they're going to get a big fee out of it. External recruiters, everybody knows, it can be pretty expensive. And if I'm going to be, tacking on a large price tag to that, I better be providing a really solid service. And I always think about, it's funny, I think about Jerry Maguire when he's saying, help me help you. And I feel like that so much with my clients. Give me feedback. Tell me about you. And the more information I have, the better able I am to serve my clients. And a lot of recruiters just kind of throw resumes around and they hope that they're going to get a fee from it. And it works. They can get fees from that. But I just don't personally find that fulfilling. I'm very much so a relationship person. And because of that, I also represent my clients better. Because I know them, I'm part of, if a recruiter is recruiting for a company, they're part of that candidate experience. And if I know my client and I understand them, I can represent them much better. And those candidates are going to have a better experience. They're more likely to be closed in the end if they're a top candidate. And in the end, it's a better experience for everyone. Win-win-win, I guess you could say.
Absolutely. So what are some of the common misconceptions about recruiters, and how should a hiring manager select a recruiter to work with?
It's really touching on what I just spoke about, in the sense that oftentimes companies think we're just a vendor. Here's a job description. I want a staff accountant with this skill set. Go and find me that person. And they don't really want to, say a hiring manager or business owner, they don't really want to open up the doors and really share with the external recruiter who they are. They feel a little more protective about their business or what have you, and that's really doing their business a disservice, because the recruiter can't truly serve them and find the best candidate if they don't really know who the business is and what makes them tick. A lot of clients are hesitant to give clear feedback, which makes it very difficult for a recruiter to hone and tweak their search in order to find the better candidate. So they're kind of spinning their wheels and not finding the best people. And it's about, you know, people are the backbone of the business, truly. And if you're not finding the best top talent, you're not going to continue to grow. And it's tremendous. It's such a big issue. And I think that's the biggest misconception. It's more of a mishandling than a misconception, that they treat them like a vendor versus a true external partner.
Well, Amber, okay, so we complete our interview. You go back to your office, and the ideal client calls you. What are the characteristics of an ideal client for you?
I think most importantly, it's one who wants to grow strategically, that they really want to find the best people for their team. They understand the value of building their team and their top talent. They are growing, of course, but they want to do so strategically, and they want to, they know their purpose. That's helpful, or that they're willing to dive in and figure that out. And how are we going to put language around that? You know, many of my clients have a higher purpose, but they don't know how to illustrate that and how to brand that in employment branding. So I think truly any company, I'm fairly industry agnostic because I've grown up recruiting in the accounting space, the administrative space, and really kind of that operational backbone of companies. So I'm very industry agnostic. So it's really more about a strategic planner who wants to very strategically grow their business, and they're willing to learn and grow and try out some new tactics through employment branding or different ways of finding their candidates.
Perfect. So when a client does approach you, do you often find that they need help in creating their branding or their purpose-driven branding message to candidates out there in today's candidate-driven market?
Yes, I do find that. Many of my clients have that purpose, and it's there, it's in their mission, but they're not communicating it as well as they could. And employment branding is again, a big catchphrase. It's a big deal. You can't just post positions on the job boards. You need to become, if you're growing pretty dramatically, you definitely need to have employment branding and approach your marketing not just for capturing clients, but capturing talent. And that's very much so figuring out what makes you guys tick and how are you going to communicate that message and find the right audience.
Great. Could you help our audience a little bit by maybe illustrating, tell us a little story about a client situation where you came in and helped them to do what you just mentioned, and then had great success with them as far as finding the team that they needed?
Absolutely. I recently was working with a client. Well, about 10 months ago, I sat down with them, and they were looking for just traditional external recruiting, and started recruiting for them. But as I sat down in that initial meeting, they had told me about all the growth that they were going to be experiencing. And I asked them, how are you going to be handling all this growth? Are you just going to be using external recruiters? And they said, well, predominantly we're going to post positions and use external recruiters. And I said, wow, you probably want to do something about that, because you're going to be spending a small fortune on recruiting if you're not careful. And about 10 months later, they reached out and they said, you know what, Amber, you were right. We're spending a small fortune on recruiting. What do we do? What are we going to do about this? And I came in, did analysis of their current talent acquisition strategy and their team. They've got great, and we discovered their strengths and their weaknesses, if you will. They have a great mission and a purpose, but they don't language that well. And so we found some really great wordsmiths, even within their company. So we surveyed their current staff and found some really great taglines and messaging that we were able to then put out into the world. And they've got a great marketing team that is already in place marketing to clients, but they just needed to create a marketing plan as it relates to employment, because they're going to continue to grow exponentially with 100 more hires in the next year and what have you. So we've been crafting that and really just discovering who you are, what makes you tick, and how do we message that? And where do we go to find them? So we're definitely using social media, the local colleges, through podcasts, through a lot of different continuing education classes to really reach possible candidates in all ways possible, but with leading that, hey, we have a higher purpose, and this is what it is.
That's great. You know, you mentioned earlier post and pray as a recruiting strategy. Just maybe that worked at one point, right? But not today. How often do you find that it's important to, you're generally recruiting to people that have jobs these days, right? I mean, with full employment. So you need to sweeten the pot a little bit extra. And some people say, well, we have a great salary, we have great benefits, but everybody has that. What, you mentioned the purpose. How important is that to luring someone away from an existing job that they might have? And based on that alone, is that enough, or does it have to be compensation or some kind of a sweetener in the comp package?
That's a really good question. Purpose is, and being a conscious company, I think is a really, that's a big definition. What does that mean? How am I purposeful? There's so many ways to actually be purposeful. And some of it is truly by creating a great culture. So it's definitely that full package, I would say. And it's going to depend on the candidate and really what matters to them. So I think that what's most important, if you're in a rapidly growing company, you need to kind of have all your ducks in a row as best as possible. So know kind of your intrinsic higher mission and value, know how to message that, have a great culture, have good benefits, and take care of your people, have social responsibility programs in place. So it may not be, you can still sell a widget and still have higher purpose. And you can be doing that through, service projects that the company goes out and does together, or expecting your employees to serve in some capacity. Actually two clients that I spoke with in the last 2 weeks, newer clients to me that I'm getting to know, literally that's part of their vetting process, is how are you involved in the community? What difference are you making as a candidate? Mm-hmm. So even my clients are expecting their candidates to have some sort of give back mentality. So it's really just a blend of all of those things. And, how do you source your products? And where do you get them? Do you recycle in your company? Sometimes it is about a stocked fridge. But it's really kind of finding what is that current wound that somebody has in their current position, what's missing, and are you filling that void?
It is an ever-changing world as cultures shift and millennials come into the workplace in a big way. And Amber, I'm sure that your clients are really happy that you crossed their path, or their path crossed yours, whichever happened. But you know, it's easy to get in touch with Amber Goff at Talent Fusion Point. Her website is www.talentfusionpoint.com. Couldn't be any easier than that. Is there another? What would they find at your website that you'd like them to look at once they get there, Amber?
I think just one last tidbit. I really practice what I preach. And so if I expect my clients to have a higher purpose and to be giving back and making the world a better place, so should I. So when I do actually work with and serve my clients, I give a certain percentage of my profits to their nonprofit of choice. So I show that I support them through their causes as well. And I think that's the little fun last tidbit that I would say, is that I do practice what I preach.
Well, that's terrific, and that speaks volumes to people that are, you know, saying, you know, okay, you're all about purpose and passion and all this stuff. What are you doing about it? So, Amber, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. Besides your web address, which I gave out, talentfusionpoint.com, is there any other way you'd like people to communicate with you?
Always LinkedIn. I, you know, recruiters live and die by LinkedIn, so you can always reach out to me there. I post a lot of things that are going on there in terms of things that are happening in the community. So absolutely connect with me on LinkedIn.
There you go, Amber Goff, G-O-U-G-H. Amber, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Guest is Gary Melling today. He is with Acquired Insights, Inc., the co-founder and CEO of that firm. And Gary is an interesting individual. He's going to be talk about bringing artificial intelligence to life. We can go a lot of different ways with that. But let me tell you a bit about their firm. They're a strategic management consulting and systems aggregator firm focusing on delivering applied artificial intelligence and machine learning, predictive analytics, cybersecurity, cryptocurrency, blockchain, humanoid robotics, chatbot, and 3D avatar business solutions, resulting in immediate, measurable, and scalable value for our clients through better real-time business decision support. Now, we only have a 20-minute show here, so we better get right into it. Gary, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Gary, all the things that I just mentioned, I'm sure our listeners are scratching their heads going, you lost me at artificial intelligence. The rest of it is future-based things that we're seeing all the time. Of course, cybersecurity is with us a lot, cryptocurrency, et cetera. But where would you like to start? Because I'd love to learn more about how you started Acquired Insights, Inc., and what your background is, and then let's get into the conversation.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about AI and machine learning and really provide maybe some basic definitions of what they are so we have a platform to build on. And as far as my background goes, I've been doing this for a long time. Back in the early 80s, I was involved in classified military projects where we were actually working on technology that was very similar to what you see today. And we take for granted when we think of Google Earth, for example, being able to take a look at an airplane flying, you know, over 30,000 feet and being able to read the newspaper over somebody's shoulder. This was what we were doing back in the 80s. So I don't pretend to be up to speed on what's going on now, but certainly it's gone a long way since then. I've worked in management consulting, some of the big five firms, been an entrepreneur involved in startups in the AI space and just general tech. So it's a passion of mine. I really enjoy what I do, and I work with a great team.
Well, terrific. So artificial intelligence, let's start with that. Where are we and where are we going with artificial intelligence and this term machine learning?
Well, I think, to be brutally honest, we are, it's like the wild, wild west right now. When we think of artificial intelligence, keep in mind it's been around for the better part of 50 years. It hasn't been commercialized until more recently. But there's been a lot of really good work done in R&D in artificial intelligence and machine learning for the last several decades. I would suggest that while it's come out of the U.S. and Canada, You know, there are mega centers and clusters, whether it's Silicon Valley or the Research Triangle Park or Atlanta area. They're a variety of different hubs. In Canada, we have Toronto and Montreal. And I think what we've seen over the last decade is an emergence of technology and special interest in artificial intelligence that's sort of gone worldwide. So now, of course, we have hubs in India and Eastern Europe and the UK, and it's really become much more of a staple. The challenge is that it's a foot race, and you have a lot of startups where you have on the one end of the spectrum, you'll have companies that are startups of recent grads, and I'm sure they have a very fine education and, you know, shiny new laptops and so on. But the challenge for a CFO or a chief risk officer in a financial services institution, as an example, is that in the absence of functional experience or business experience, particular and relevant to financial services, it's really hard for an executive to trust their business continuity to a startup where they don't have that kind of experience. On the other end, you have companies that are, you know, perhaps very deep and rich in experience. Our AI team has over 18 years of experience and working as a team as well. So we're in a kind of a unique position, but there to the potential buyer, it's confusing. And so I think that what we're going to see in the next 12 to 18 months, particularly in North America, is a faster way for corporations to qualify startups. Most startups are not in a position where they can wait a year to navigate through the procurement and legal system of a potential client organization that may be a Fortune 2000. They don't have the bandwidth or the resources to wait that 1 year out while all the processing happens. So one thing that corporations are going to have to get much, much better at is recognizing when they're working with startups, and whether it's in AI or other areas, they need to create a way to fast track the due diligence, because these companies just, again, don't have the resources to be in an endless loop of qualification. As far as adopting the technology goes, what we're seeing is that organizations traditionally have been, I call it vacuuming the ocean for data. They've got so many data sources, and they continue to gather more and more and to feed the machine, to feed the beast. But often what's lost is understanding which data is important, which data is predictive, which data can be used for meaningful decision support. And so I think we're going to start to see fine-tuning of the kind of data that's gathered, because while it's great to be able to buy memory relatively inexpensively, the data can clearly get out of hand. And when you have that much data, you really have to take a look at, is the data clean? Does it need to be scrubbed? Is it complete? Are we missing something? Is something germane to making specific decisions in a specific part of our business? And then, of course, there are all the privacy issues, and we have the GDPR regulations on data privacy access. We have cybersecurity. I think that what we're seeing in the next 12 to 18 months is not only a firmer grasp of trying to identify which data they need to capture versus capturing everything. I think what we'll also see is more and more organizations moving to predictive behavioral data. Right now, most organizations are working with what we call structured data. And let's just make it all really simple. Structured data is the kind of data that a corporation would keep in a large computer system, an enterprise resource planning system, an ERP system. So they might have Oracle or PeopleSoft or a handful of the other large ERP systems. And the challenge with that kind, with capturing that kind of data is relatively easy, because it's all accessible. It's usually the same data just being updated over and over again. What we're also seeing, though, is while that is structured data, I know it was research came out about 2 years ago suggesting that 90% of all the data that has ever been created in the world has been created in the last 24 months. And 90% of that data is what we call unstructured data. So unstructured data is not the kind of data we just talked about a moment ago. It's not the kind of data you'll see in a large computer database system. It's things like emails, voice recordings, photographs, videos. Think of social media. So that's an excellent example of the kind of unstructured data that we're seeing. Now, if you add on top of that, what we believe is where the real secret sauce is going to be, it's in the behavioral data. And behavioral data is a subset of that unstructured data. And we've all probably had some familiarity and examples with behavioral data. For example, if you order something on Amazon and it says to you, oh, by the way, Bill, people who bought this book also bought the following six books. So
it's using
you know, some predictive analytics and some behavioral data. It's monitoring your purchasing habits. It's logging all of that information. And it's being able to refer to it again to say, aha, okay, Bill's visiting again. The last time he was here, he bought this book. So we're going to see much more of that. We're only scratching the surface right now. And when you start to think of that being applied, let's say, in healthcare, retail, manufacturing, mining, telecom, the customer experience can be tailored and tailored in real time to just about anybody in any industry, anywhere in the world. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that. But the first segment is going to be to, I think, transition a little bit from the structured data more into using the unstructured data. When corporations are only using 20% of their available data, that's the structured data. And, you know, companies like ours can unlock the access and capacity to use that other 80%. It's going to provide them with tremendous insights on the customers, on the competitors, market analysis, and so on.
It's fascinating, and it's a new frontier of, you know, 50-year-old new front overnight success, right? I've been working on for a long time. Yet what always interests me is the fact that what you're explaining so beautifully, it's very clear to me, but that there's been a lot of logic-based data available, but and especially we're talking about cars that drive themselves, et cetera, et cetera. How do you program in that the person next to you just dropped a soft drink or a cup of coffee in their lap and they're going to swerve, the unexpected, unintentional, or emotional type of issue that can come up for us as humans, and how does artificial intelligence get programmed to prepare for that unexpected swerve?
Great, great question. Well, I think there, in just general terms, there are probably a couple of topics we would probably touch on. And one would be the nature of bias. So whenever we take a look at anything to do with computers, if we try to replicate anything, you know, for example, you know, again, artificial intelligence, it's a branch of computer science dealing with the simulation of intelligent behavior in computers. Now, before we can engage in artificial intelligence, what typically happens is we start first with machine learning. And machine learning focuses on the development of computer programs that can access data and use it to learn for themselves. So before we actually engage the artificial intelligence, we have to start with the machine learning. And let's say, for example, the example you just gave in a car. As we pull up to a stop sign, we don't want to be right half the time. We want to be right all the time. We want to be sure the car comes to a complete stop. When we take a look at a stop sign, it's an eight-sided figure. It's red. It's got letters in it. And on a beautiful sunny day and with an unobstructed view, it should be very easy in machine learning to train that computer system to recognize a stop sign. But where it gets a little bit sticky is, let's imagine now it's an overcast day. Let's imagine there's a bit of a breeze, and the breeze is blowing a branch in front of the stop sign. Well, that stop sign might not now be quite so easy to delineate as a stop sign. So we then go from machine learning to deep learning. And in deep learning, we basically offer hundreds, maybe even thousands of more scenarios of what this stop sign might look like given all these extraneous conditions. So there are ways that we can approach solving some of these problems, whether it's using machine learning, deep learning, or whether we're actually starting to focus on elements of self-bias, cognitive biases. When we're human, as we begin to program computers, one of the things that happens, and we don't necessarily do it consciously, is we start to take a look at including some of our values, some of our reasoning into the logic. Again, it's more subconscious than anything. And these are called cognitive biases. And there have been a variety of different papers written on them. I just read one recently where we talk about 24 different cognitive biases that are potentially warping perception of reality. And when we use these subconscious cognitive biases, we can skew how the artificial intelligence or machine learning is actually learning. And so it doesn't necessarily give us a pure answer, the answer that we might be looking for. It could be just somewhat biased, just as the name describes. Well, one of the things about artificial intelligence is if we can identify that bias is going on, and if we're aware of the different classifications of bias, we can actually start to build algorithms that challenge the artificial intelligence to see if, in fact, bias has been built in to how it's operating. So this is where artificial intelligence can actually be used on itself to clear the deck, so to speak, of that kind of potential problem.
I don't know why I just said wow. I mean, as humans, we do this all the time, right? I mean, we've got the supercomputer in our brain. I guess one question, for instance, in financial services, which you mentioned earlier, which of course is robotics, robo trading is all the rage right now. One of the key benefits of a human being, stockbroker, for instance, is to talk somebody out of a bad idea. If for instance, you were to get online and say the market's falling, sell right away, the computer would likely, I would imagine, follow your instructions instead of saying, hey, are you sure? Because this is going to come back. And even if the computer were to do that, I guess the bigger psychological question is, will humans ever cede over the authority to say, no, yeah, you got this. You take this computer. I trust you. In a way, we do this many times, and sometimes we've been burned if our old MapQuest ended us at the end of a dead end street and said you're home. You know, that type of a thing.
Sure.
And so the forward based question is: will we ever trust a car with no steering wheel? Something we can't grab a hold of, because we'll mostly trust a computer to get us where we want to go. It's the old trust but verify type of a phrase, I guess.
I think we will. It's not going to happen today or tomorrow, but I think we're headed down that road already. If we think of what it was like 100 years ago and commercial flying, people talk about people flying in the sky. Or traveling at high speeds on trains, or Henry Ford thinking about asking, general population, what is it they'd like to see in transportation? They would have said faster horses,
mm-hmm. Right,
when we
right,
take
right.
a look at how all this technology evolves, I don't think it's a matter of if, I just think it's a matter of when. So if it's mm-hmm. 5 years, whether it's 20 years, I really do believe that as the artificial intelligence, machine learning, predictive analytics, the data sources become more refined. The updating of those data sources is basically real time. We'll be in a position where I think it'll just become second nature.
Yeah, and good point. And as a new generation is born and brought up with the technology at hand, they don't fear it. They embrace it from the beginning. So what can the average person do to get prepared for the changes that AI and machine learning will bring?
I would say anything you see on the TV, anything you hear on the radio, any book that you happen, a magazine article, anything that is really discussing the topic of artificial intelligence or robots or computers in general, read it, follow it, get engaged. There's so much out there. Now, not all of it necessarily makes sense, and There are obviously people within the same field that would debate the validity of one point of view versus a different point of view. But the only way you can actually get, you know, to a point where you're familiar enough to have those kinds of debates is to start with a baseline of information and turn that into knowledge and then be able to apply it in a forward-thinking way as wisdom. And that all starts with a single step. So I would say, you know, even if you're a person isn't necessarily the first one to pick up an article in a magazine or to watch a news item or see something on their computer screen about artificial intelligence, whether it's an ad or a video, take the time. It's coming. I say it's coming. It's here. The challenge is that most people tend to be thinking that it's so far off in the future, you don't really need to worry about it. And I can tell you that there are different pockets in the world where they not only accept artificial intelligence and machine learning and robots, they run towards it. A concern I currently have about North America is that if we compare, let's say, South Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, to what we're doing in North America, and as far as adopting artificial intelligence in how we do our banking, in how we interact with a variety of different quote-unquote machines, we're kind of delayed here in North America. In some of the countries I've mentioned, every element of an individual's banking is done on their phone. They have a chatbot that they talk to. They can go into their profile and configure someone who looks and sounds like them as their avatar. That avatar can service that client's needs, take a look at their credit reports and loan applications or lines of credit or whatever it is. And they can actually tie it to rewards programs, and where they have rewards in place, they can automatically, this is all done through artificial intelligence, allow that person to be followed through in a day in the life and have that entire journey supported by artificial intelligence. Now, that's clearly the more advanced ways that it's being used. But here in North America, on the other hand, while we've got a good base, and there's certainly been some, as well as in Canada, we've done some R&D that is world-class, I think for the most part, there are exceptions, but for the most part, we've rested on our laurels of the R&D while the rest of the world has been actually implementing it and embracing it. One of the things we have to do, I think, is make it part of and recognize it's that robotics are already part of our day and have been for a very long time. And people will say to me, well, how can you say that? You know, I don't have a robot in my home. And I'll say, well, of course you do. Well, what do you mean? Well, do you have an automated coffee maker? Yes, programmable. Yeah. Do you have a printer for your computer? Yeah. Do you have a remote control and a garage door opener? Yeah. Well, those are all robots. They might not take a human form. They might not be sophisticated in the sense of being empathetic or using some of the more recent technology and facial recognition and, you know, all that other stuff. But the essential role of a robot is to do work. And all of these machines that I've just described, photocopiers, they're doing printing. They're actually replacing a human in a printing press and, you know, all the things that we used to see in the old days. So there's been this very slow recognition that they've been here for a while. And what I think we're starting to see because of press stories and news items and so on, we're starting to see things that are startling us. There are applications of AI in pharmaceutical and biosciences and synthetic skin and, you know, all kinds of things that are being worked on. And no one thing is going to solve all the world's problems, which means that we need to be, generally speaking, just more aware. And I think that awareness is going to come from reading and hearing and listening and watching as much as we can about it and trying to put it in a context where we understand what does it mean for us as individuals? What does it mean for our town or city? What does it mean for our state or province? What does it mean for our country? There was an interesting quote I saw that really kind of fascinated me. And it was actually said in September 7th of 2007. The quote is, artificial intelligence is the future, not only for Russia, but for all humankind. It comes with colossal opportunities, but also threats that are difficult to predict. Who whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become the ruler of the world. And that was President Vladimir Putin. Well, there are other countries and pockets around the world where they truly, truly understand the implications of artificial intelligence. Now, do they have all the answers? No, but they're in the pursuit of those answers. And I think as in general society in North America, we just need to be more engaged. And, you know, I can see having discussions about artificial intelligence or the application of artificial intelligence at a dinner table. Those are the kinds of discussions that you know, the people that I work with and on a regular basis are having. And I don't think we're that far off from those being commonplace.
Well, if I were starting that conversation at a dinner table, I certainly hope you would be there with me, because I think it'd be a very interesting conversation. And it's been fascinating to talk with you about this, Gary. And I note that for active, progressive business owners that qualify, your firm offers an online business continuity risk profile assessment, followed up with a complimentary confidential 30-minute telephone consultation. And I take it that that's aiming towards the cybersecurity side of things. But I think it would behoove any of our listeners to get in touch with you. And I note that your website is www.aiinc.cloud, aiinc.cloud. Gary, it's been fascinating to talk with you, and I really think I'd love to get another interview scheduled with you as quick as possible, because we just started to scratch the surface, but we laid down a very nice foundation for future conversations. So thank you.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.